This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we'll be talking about an AI algorithm studying pain and a story that may drive you to nuts. But first, last week, we anticipated the impending green light for use of the Pfizer COVID vaccine in adolescents. That approval came through this week, and people aged 12 to 15 can now get the vaccine. This week, the CDC changed its guidance on the coronavirus somewhat, officially acknowledging what many people have been taking for granted, the airborne nature of the virus's spread. And the CDC said that fully vaccinated people might be able to go mask-free in many situations. In fact, CDC head Rochelle Walensky spoke at a White House briefing yesterday.
Anyone who is fully vaccinated can participate in indoor and outdoor activities, large or small, without wearing a mask or physical distancing. If you are fully vaccinated, you can start doing the things that you had stopped doing because of the pandemic.
Here to talk about that and other short subjects in science is Sarah Zhang, staff writer for The Atlantic. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for having me.
So the big COVID news this week for many people is probably this guidance that masks might not be necessary for fully vaccinated people. Help us unpack that a bit.
So the CDC says that if you're vaccinated, you don't have to wear a mask indoors, though there are a couple exceptions. The couple exceptions are doctor's offices and public transportation, because these are places where your risk of exposure might just be higher. From the biology itself, this makes a lot of sense. We know right now that if you are vaccinated, you're very unlikely to get sick. If you do get sick, you're very unlikely to get seriously sick. So it is quite clear that if you're vaccinated, the risk to yourself is just very, very low at this point. I think where the remaining questions are and where people might, you know, still have some hesitations is that a lot of parents, their kids might still not be vaccinated, or if they're young, they might not be vaccinated for a long time. So I think one thing to think about this is the floor, right? Like cities and local governments and even individual stores might still have mask guidances, and you know, we'll still have to follow this.
I guess there might be a lot of trust involved here, because the challenge is that now you won't know if someone is in fact vaccinated or just refusing to wear a mask.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's what people who, you know, still have unvaccinated people in their lives are worried about, right? The risk is certainly not zero, just because even in very small cases, you can be vaccinated and still perhaps get it asymptomatically. But it does still reduce the risk a lot. And of course, if you're still worried, feel free to keep wearing a mask.
Of course. And in other COVID news, a committee of the World Health Organization issued a report on what went wrong last year in the early stages of a global response to the disease. And it called February 2020, quote, a lost month. Tell us why that is.
Yeah. Well, if you remember back to February 2020, I think those of us in the U.S., we were seeing all these countries in Asia locked down. We had a lot of questions about how are these going to affect our supply chains? And no one was really thinking that much, oh, this is going to happen to us. So this report from, it's an independent panel set up by the WHO to kind of assess how we did. And looking back over the year, I think we can all agree that we could have done a lot better. The panel has a bunch of specific recommendations for what the WHO could have done. But I think the big takeaway for me, the big conceptual takeaway, is the precautionary principle, which is that we should act even before we are perfectly certain of something. And so remember, a year ago, we had all these questions. Is this virus spreading from person to person? Is it spreading asymptomatically? Is it airborne? And it took some time for the evidence to really accumulate 100%. And so when you're acting on a pandemic, you sometimes need to act before you know it's 100%. Maybe it's starting to look likely that is asymptomatic. Okay, we need to start making sure that people are wearing masks and shutting down even before we're 100% sure of that.
Yeah, don't assume anything. Take precautions in advance. In other news, let's move on. It appears that the Colonial Pipeline has paid that ransom to get its pipeline back online.
Yes, that's right.
Is there a gas shortage or is there not? It sort of seems it depends on where you live.
It does seem to depend on where you live. So the Colonial Pipeline carries about half the fuel on the East Coast. So it was shut down for about a week. And I think they just turned it back on Wednesday. So that did cause a bit of a supply crunch. But the other thing that was happening is that people were hearing about the hack. People were going out and filling up their cars. And then there were lines at the gas station. Then people were saying, oh, there are lines at the gas station. the gas stations are running out. I have to go to the gas station. So suddenly you had this huge spike in demand as well. The problem was not that there was not enough gas on the East Coast necessarily, but just that it was not in the right places where people wanted it at this moment.
Yeah, because there were some photos of people filling up just about any plastic container they could get their hands on.
Yes, which you should not do.
No. You know, did this not sort of remind you of the great toilet paper crisis from last March?
Yeah. You know, in the same way, is that it wasn't like that there was necessarily a lack of toilet paper in the world. It was just about getting the right toilet paper to the right people who wanted it at this exact time. Suddenly everyone wanted it at the same time, and then you had a problem.
Did they actually figure out what was behind this pipeline problem?
The pipeline itself was actually not hacked. What happened was that the company that runs the pipeline was hacked. It's called a ransomware hack. They basically stole their data and said, unless you pay us this money, you can't do anything. The reporting suggests that it actually took down their billing system. And of course, the company was worried that they weren't able to run anything, so they kind of just shut everything down for several days. The kind of ironic thing is that I think they actually paid the ransom, but kind of unlocking their data took so long that it was faster for them to just go back and restore through their backups. Is a kind of a ironic little twist there.
Yeah, this is sort of portends bad news for any other infrastructure.
Yeah, you know, all of our, you know, our electrical plants, you know, these are all really vulnerable to hacks like this.
Yeah, not only that, but our financial institutions, banks, maybe the stock market.
Yeah, these ransomware hacks have actually been happening usually to smaller institutions, but they've been happening at hospitals, local institutions, at local city governments. And a lot of times, you know, if you're a small, I think in this case, the government got involved and Clio Pipeline's a pretty big company. But if you're a small company, sometimes you just have to pay up because that seems like the easiest way to deal with
it. Like the hospitals. Let's move on to other news. There's important old seed news this week. Old seeds.
Old seeds have sprouted. So the reason this is important is because this is actually part of a 140-year experiment to see how long seeds can last. So back in 1879, a botanist by the name of William James Beale had actually hidden thousands of seeds around Michigan. He literally buried them in a secret spot. And the idea is that he and his future colleagues every 20 years will go out and dig up these seeds under the cover of dark and then plant them and they see if they will still sprout. And so this latest excavation happened this past April, and some of these seeds have sprouted, about a dozen of them so far.
Wow. What kinds of seeds are we talking about here?
Yeah, well, the funny thing is that it seems like all of the seeds that have sprouted all belong to one species, something called a moth mullein, which is like a flowering herb. The slightly bad news is that they are an invasive species. So now that we know that they can stay in the ground for 140 years and still germinate, that's not great.
No. Well, that might explain why they're so invasive, too.
Exactly.
You have a story about an aquarium favorite, the betta fish, the Siamese fighting fish. You know, those brightly colored fish kept in little round bowls. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so these fish were initially domesticated in Southeast Asia, where they're native, as you said, fighting fish, right? They're kind of like an aquatic version of cockfights that people like to watch and bet on. And so scientists were actually really interested in studying the genetics of aggression in these fish because they're easy to keep in the lab, especially compared to something like a bull or a chicken that might be bred for aggression. A betta fish is a lot easier. And so they went and looked at the DNA of these domesticated betta fish, and they actually found something unrelated that was surprising, which is that they have a sex gene that is not found in the same way in wild betta fish. So this might seem like, you know, they have a sex gene that's pretty normal. But what's unusual about fish is that the way they become male or female is just so varied and so diverse and far weirder than we think of as humans. Sometimes it's based on temperature. Sometimes if it's all males, one of the males will turn into a female. So we don't really know what's going on in wild betta fish. But in the process of breeding betta fish that are more beautiful, maybe better fighters, we seem to have also accidentally given them a sex gene.
Wow. Who knew? I guess now we know, right?
Now we know. Yeah. No one set out looking for it, but there it was.
So they don't know what accounts for this, the sex in the wild betta fish.
No, it might be more than one factor. You know, sometimes breeders have talked about maybe temperature affecting whether it's going to be a mostly female or mostly male brood. But it might be multifactorial. There are other not betta fish, but there are other species of fish out there that have kind of similar chromosomes to humans and XY. Others have similar chromosomes to birds. Some have both at the same time. It's just there are dozens and dozens of ways in which sex is determined in fish.
Really interesting. Sticking with our potential pet theme this morning, there's a cat psychology news, the whole cats in boxes effect. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so we probably all know that cats love boxes and shopping bags and suitcases. And the theory is that these boxes just feel safe, right? They're kind of like swaddled and like sheltered from everything else in the world. But what's also interesting is that cats also love to sit on flat objects, like 2D objects. Like if I leave a sweater on my bed, my cat will always sit on the sweater, which is annoying because then sometimes I want to wear the sweater. Or if there are videos where if you take a scarf and you make a circle on the ground, the cat will go and sit inside that circle. Or even if you just like tape a box on the ground, the cats will go and sit inside that box. So the latest wrinkle to this is scientists actually did a study where what happens if you don't even have a box, you just have an illusion of a box. This is an optical illusion where you take a circle, kind of cut out some wedges and arrange them so it looks like there's a box, but it's not actually enclosed. And it seems like even then, some cats will go sit in this illusory box. 500 cats were participated, only 30 made it through, as you can imagine, being cats. But it does seem like that they're fooled even by this optical illusion.
Wow. So we've now given all our listeners something to do this weekend with their cats. Make that illusion.
Exactly.
Thank you very much, Sarah.
Thank you.
Sarah Zhang, staff writer for The Atlantic.